Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery. And that is why the Machinery Digest exists. A no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello and welcome to Idle Chatter. I'm Ray Bohax, the Hot Rod Farmer, coming to you from Cat Swamp Road in Warren County, New Jersey, and from the Farm Machinery Digest. Well, today is going to be in, take number two with my new podcast equipment. I want to apologize for my show last week that some of the audio was not what I had hoped it would be, and I was playing around with this new equipment and a lot more complicated than I was used to. But one of the things that were wrong with it, or was wrong, I should say, was nothing that I was doing. Yeah, I had some of the adjustments, the gain for the microphone, some other settings wrong. I'm guilty of that. But my major problem was that the unit needed a firmware update. And it was crazy. I mean, it's brand new, and it needed a firmware update. And in last week's show, I said that I was not going to update it until I got a couple of podcasts under my belt with it, but I didn't like the audio quality. The information, I have to honestly say, was good. The audio quality, I felt, left a good deal to be desired. And hopefully this show is going to be much better today once I loaded the new firmware in. And also, this new firmware does give me a pause button. So with my allergies and everything I have running down my throat, and my voice started to break up pretty badly in that show last week, but I did not want to stop the recording and then have my web person, my podcast guru, Susan Moore, have to cut and paste the shows together, because it's a slightly new system for her also. So hopefully I got those bugs out of it. I love the unit. It's from Rode, as I said. I think they call it a soundboard, or the industry calls it a soundboard. And well, hopefully, God willing, that this show, the audio is much better, and I'm going to look to tweak it, because I like to tune stuff, so I'm going to look to tweak it every week, and then I'm recording my settings and knowing where I have to go with it. So I apologize again for any inconvenience it may have caused you. I thank you for bearing with me and listening to the show. And the show last week was the one about tire pressures and farm tires. So good information there. Like I said, not because it's from me, but good information. And just hopefully you could deal with the poor audio quality. But today's show I'm excited about, because I'm using this new equipment and I feel I got it tuned up much better. So it was like that. It's like you're tuning up an engine. When she doesn't run right, you don't feel that good about it. But when she's purring and she's idling beautifully, boy, you really, really get excited about that. But I am going to introduce a toolbox test question today. And every week on the show, there's going to be a question from my toolbox test, which is found on my website. Every month I do a five question multiple choice test, and this is going to be from test number one, question one. But if you enjoy them, you could go up to the website, farmmachinerydigest.com, click on the tab for toolbox test, and then you could get all the tests there and you could take them one by one. So each test, as I said, has five questions, is multiple choice, and then when you hit submit, it will give you the proper answers back. So that is something that I designed to be a learning tool for everyone who comes to the site. and I give an explanation, a brief explanation of why the answer is correct, and not just saying that the proper answer is A or B. So we're going to introduce that today, and hopefully everyone likes it. I think it should be a good learning experience and a lot of fun. Now, keep in mind that when I do the toolbox test, I am going to give you the potential answers as A, B, C, and D. Obviously, there's no two-way communication between us, that I'm only talking to you, I can't hear you. So don't be concerned whether you felt the answer was A, B, C, or D. Be concerned with what the verbiage of the answer is. So water flows A, uphill, B, downhill, C, sideways. So we know the water flows downhill. So don't be concerned with whether it's A, B, C, or D. I will give you the letter, but I will also read the response to you. And I'm going to read those questions from my toolbox test, and I'm going to read the response that I have there. And the reason why I'm going to do it that way is because I have a tendency to go off on a tangent, and I don't want this to go on for an hour. So you know how I am. Once I get off on a tangent, forget about it. It's very hard to pull me in. But what I want to also do is just revisit the fact of the firmware in this soundboard. And that is a reason why I feel that autonomous cars, trucks, and tractors will never truly become mainstream or actually be used to any magnitude. Because here this is, I'm not going to say this is a simple soundboard, but it's a soundboard, and the firmware being incorrect or wrong or what have you, the complexity of it had me chasing my tail for 2 days. And no matter what I did, if it was a carburetor, you'd say the change got lost inside the carburetor. When you tune in a carburetor, specifically like a race carburetor, you could change the jets, the air bleed, what have you. And you say, geez, you know, I made two jet changes. I made, you know, three air bleed sizes. Then the carburetor really isn't responding. So we would say that it's lost inside the carburetor. And then what was happening with this soundboard was that I was making changes to it. I was making changes to the gain on the microphone. I was making changes on the fader and a couple other things. And it really wasn't making a drastic difference. So what I did was that I used hot rod farmer mentality. When you're trying to tune something or find out what's going on, you make huge changes. You go way rich and then go way lean, so you get a handle on what's happening. If you make incremental changes at that particular point, oftentimes you can't tell what's going on. And so I said, I'm going to hit it with a big hammer. And I made big changes, and I really didn't see the result in the quality of the audio. So I said, well, I'm going to download this new firmware and see what it is. If it locks it up, it locks it up. Whatever, if it goes bad, it burns it up. I'll go back to my old system until I get this fixed. But it loaded beautifully. It was very, very intuitive. And I believe that it's going to work much, much better. Now it'll work as it should. So I just hopefully that you guys feel the same way about that. So now, the other thing I wanted to bring up to you is that as we are in October now, I am going to start to work on another Hot Rod Farmer gift-giving guide. And I did that last year at the last, I don't want to say at the last minute, but the podcast was new, the website was new. We're just coming up on our anniversary, I think another week or so from when this show airs will be our one-year anniversary. And I decided around just before Thanksgiving last year to do a Hot Rod Farmer Gift Giving Guide podcast, and then also a article on my website to support it, so you could see actual pictures of the different things that I suggested, and also get website addresses and what have you. So I'm going to do that again, but I'm going to start earlier so that I could get that to you right for Thanksgiving weekend, for Black Friday. And hopefully you will enjoy listening to that show. It's going to be an abbreviated show. It's going to be in addition to that week's podcast. And it'll also be supported on the website. And interestingly enough, I was quite pleasantly surprised that show, the gift giving guide last year, really had a lot of legs. I mean, it was still pulling a lot of audience into March and April. So I was very, very pleased with that. And, you know, the thing basically is that those are tools and things you could use in the farm shop. They're not really dedicated for Christmas. But the fact is that And that was my intent. So I was really, really happy that the thing had long legs. And believe it or not, people are still listening to it now. So I'm really, really pleased about that. So, hey, look forward to that. And hard to believe that we're coming up on Thanksgiving. And the other thing is that I want to just tell you that, you know, as a farmer, I got to give a crop report, right? Well, my cover crop, my first cover crop that I planted, I don't plant, I broadcast it, was September 22nd, and it didn't rain at all, and it just sat there. And then the second planting for the other field was October 2nd, and that got some rain, and that started to come up. And believe it or not, it was interesting for me to see is that even though the first planting was sitting there for quite some time, and it had some heavy dews on it and a little drizzle, a thousandth of an inch or something, just enough to get it, just to get it wet, it really didn't show any signs of germination. But once we got an inch and a half of rain, the it must have had some moisture that got absorbed into the seed, because that planting is beating the other field, and they both got the rain at the same time. So I feel that that's pretty interesting. So the seed must have been absorbing some moisture, not enough to get it up and at them, but to give it a head start over the other one that was sitting there, that wasn't sitting there quite as long. So that's what's so much fun about the farm, is you learn something every day, and you just look at things and you see them and you learn and you say, well, geez, what's going on over here? And that's what farming is all about, right? And that's how we grow everything. So, I mean, grow as far as a human being is concerned, not to grow our crops. So what today's show is going to be about, now I just hit the pause button there and a cough button for the first time. So if you had some dead air for a second, please forgive me. And it's a little bit different. I have to hold this button down for 2 seconds, and I have to get into a sync with it. So I have to learn to keep talking up until I see it go into pause. And I don't think I did at that time. Well, hey, you know, it's all new. And I know that you guys are all great, and you're very forgiving of me. You're more forgiving of me than I deserve. And I really want to thank you for that. But what today's show is going to be about is something that almost every engine, specifically gasoline engines, but diesel engines today also use, and it is called electronic throttle control. And the nickname for it is drive-by-wire. And where that came about is that it came from the aviation industry, which was fly-by-wire, not drive-by-wire, meaning that all of the ailerons and the flaps and everything on the plane were no longer mechanically controlled. They were mechanically controlled, but the signal that would the pilot would move a lever, and that would send an electric signal, and then there would be some sort of servo that would move that, in simplistic terms. And then what had happened was that a number of years ago, they started to introduce this technology into automobiles. And as I always say, when I talk about automobiles, I mean pickup trucks and cars and the like, not just cars itself. In the industry, it's considered an automobile. And they introduced this technology. Believe it or not, I think that BMW was the first one to bring this technology to market. And there was a lot of fear about it because there was no longer a throttle cable. So when you step on the gas pedal, the accelerator pedal, on a modern vehicle, the proper name is the accelerator pedal. We call it the gas pedal, right? Even on the diesels, it's a gas pedal. But when you step on that, there is no cable that is going to operate a throttle body on a fuel injection system or to an injection pump on a diesel, which they're not really using traditional injection pumps anymore. And I'll touch on that a little bit later on. So there's no throttle cable. And what is happening is that just the accelerator is sending an electrical signal to a motor, and the motor is physically opening the throttle plates. And that is what's called electronic throttle control, or, like I say, to repeat it as a slang, drive-by-wire. And why I think it's important for you to understand this is because almost everything that you're going to have on the farm that's gasoline powered, that's not like a UTV or an ATV, is going to have drive-by-wire. I think probably for the past, it's 2019, the 2020s are out. So probably at least the past 7 or 8 years, every vehicle that came onto the market no longer has a throttle cable. And, you know, in engineering, we have an acronym called KISS, and a lot of people use it, keep it simple, stupid. And, you know, this added a level of complexity to a vehicle and to an engine control that we never had before. And, you know, the jury is out in my book of why, not why they did it. I know why they did it, but I think sometimes it's a diminishing return. Well, why did they do it? Let's start there first. You said, you know, for so many years, for 100 years, there was a throttle cable or throttle links. We had an old John Deere Oliver Row Crop 70 tractor, hard paw. So it was a tricycle, narrow front, hard paw. And that was the first tractor I drove as a kid. And it had a Continental engine, big straight inline six-cylinder Continental engine. And, you know, that had a mechanical, you know, it had a throttle linkage. It didn't have a cable, it had a throttle linkage. You would pull the throttle out and then move a linkage, and there was an adjustment of linkage, and that would go to the carburetor. And then we had a Ford 9N, and that basically had the same thing. It had a throttle linkage. It didn't have a cable. But cars, for the past 60, 70, 80 years, basically had a throttle cable. So the accelerator pedal was hooked up and pulled a cable, you know, years back against the throttle on the carburetor. And then even later on with fuel injection, it would pull against the throttle body and open the throttle plate so that more air could get into the engine. And one of the reasons why the industry wanted to get away from it is that they did not want to have a hole in the firewall. Now, you know, to the average person, the average farmer listening to the show, a hole in a firewall to run a cable through is not the end of the world. But the industry is chasing quietness in the car. And what they found is that anytime you put something through the firewall of any magnitude, you obviously have to put a grommet. If they run the wire through, they have to run a grommet also, but it's a tighter grommet than they would with a cable. And so the hole is smaller. And that hole allows noise to come into the passenger compartment. Now, yeah, in practical sense, that's what they say. But what it basically did, and you have to remember, this discussion from this point on today is going to be talking about fuel-injected engines, because there hasn't been a carburetor-built engine in the United States in a car or truck since 1987. So that's what, 32 years ago, almost 33 years ago. So we're not going to go there. We're going to talk with fuel injection. And what would happen is that in a fuel injection system, you needed to have some sort of idle speed control. And on General Motors, they called it an IAC, idle air control motor. And Chrysler used what was called an IAC. And then Ford used what they called an auxiliary air valve. And it was patterned after a Bosch style system. But in essence, regardless of what you call it or how it truly functions, its main purpose was the same thing, is that it's going to allow air to bypass the throttle plates to raise the idle speed. So when you got into a fuel injected car, let's say you got into a 1995 Ford pickup truck with a V8 and EFI, electronic fuel injection. When you started that engine and an engine would idle up high on the cold start and then come back down, the throttle was not actually moving. What happened was that there was a valve that connected to a passage that went from in front of the throttle plate to behind the throttle plate, and this valve would be like a water faucet, and it would open up and it would allow air to bypass the throttle plate, because for the engine to get more RPM, all it needed was more air. So it did not know or care how that air got there. That's why on an engine, if you disconnect a vacuum hose, and it's a small enough vacuum hose not to overly lean out the mixture, is that the engine speed will pick up, because it's air, what we would call false air. It's bypass air. It's bypassing the throttle plates. So this idle air control motor, or auxiliary air valve, the industry eventually adapted the term IAC, idle air control, regardless of what the valve design was. And this would allow air to bypass the throttle plate, and it would give it the fast idle. It would also give it the load compensation. So if you took that pickup truck, then you dropped it into drive, all right, you're going to now load the engine against the torque converter because you put it into drive instead of park or neutral, and it would compensate for that, and it would open up and give a little bit more air so that the engine speed could be controlled in drive. You put the air conditioner on. Now you load the motor a little bit more, and it's going to give it some more air to compensate for that load. Now, conversely, you're going down the highway into town, and you come into town, and there's a traffic light there. All right, we hate that, right? When they put a traffic light in town, we have lights in town. We don't have any lights by me yet. I shouldn't say we have a light about a mile away, but hopefully they don't bring any more closer. I hate traffic lights. It just seems to lose the ruralness of it. But anyway, to get back on target here, is that so now you're coming to a stop with this truck, and you're going into town, you're coming to a stop, and you release the throttle, and the engine, the engine is coasting, and the truck is coasting. The engine goes to idle. Well, what happens is that this idle speed control motor, this idle air control motor, goes and it opens up and slowly comes back, and what they call degrades, degrades out, so that the engine does not come to a stall when you come to a stop and the throttle closing too rapidly. Years ago, on some carbureted cars, they used to have what was called a dash pot. And the dash pot acted the same way. When you close the throttle, they close against a little device with a spring in it, and would be like almost like a hydraulic piston on a screen door of a house. So storm door, they call it, right? So you open up the door and then you close it, then the piston lets the door retract slowly so it doesn't slam. A lot of carburetors, specifically in the 1970s, had that, and it was called a dash pot. So it doesn't let the throttle slam close so the engine stalls. It lets it come easily like that screen door closing, that back door of the house, that screen door. And, you know, you could adjust that, right? On the screen door, you could adjust the piston, the pressure in there. And the thing is that so you can have it close quicker or close slower. Well, the same thing happened with a dash pot. So what was happening is they put this in, with fuel injection, they needed this idle air control because there was no way for them to compensate for load, give it the fast idle, or to be able to control the engine from not stalling on deceleration. So they integrated all of this, and it worked very, very, very well. And it worked very well. The only problems that they could have had with it was that if the throttle plate started to close too much or get dirty, and then the idle air control motor or auxiliary air bypass valve got dirty and would be slow to respond, then all you had to do was clean those parts, clean the throttle plates, and then there was a simple adjustment, which was basically, people call it the throttle stop screw, the idle speed screw, but it really wasn't an idle speed screw because the idle speed was controlled by the processor, by the ECU, with command and idle speed through the idle air control motor. But what it was called the minimum air rate. So it was the minimum amount of air going past the throttle plates. And that was an adjustment. And I fixed many, many cars over the years of my career, many engines that were stalling on deceleration. And it was simply because the throttle stop screw with the minimum air rate was off and the idle air control or on a Ford, the auxiliary air valve was dirty and it could not respond quick enough to the change in throttle angle. All right, so that was that, and that worked very, very well. And then what happened was that if the vehicle was equipped with cruise control, then there was actually another servo that was attached with a cable, and it would go and it would open the throttle and work the throttle back and forth when the vehicle was on cruise control. So by getting rid of the throttle cable and going to electronic throttle control or drive by wire, they did away with the auxiliary air valve / idle air control motor, and they did away with the cruise control solenoid and all those devices for the cruise control. So what would happen, and that's why so many cars today, pickup trucks, come from the factory with cruise control, and because the 99% of the components are there for the cruise control. All it is a different function that needs to be put into the microprocessor, the ECU, the engine control unit. But now, as an aside to this, I'm going to break away for a few seconds, or probably for a few minutes realistically, right? Because I'm long-winded. But as an aside to this, most, if not all, modern diesels use a throttle today, whereas all the diesels, mechanical diesels, did not use a throttle. When you stepped onto the accelerator or moved the hand throttle on a tractor or piece of farm equipment, excuse me, right? I'm breathing through my nose here. And what would happen is that you would move a lever in the injection pump and the fueling rate would change. Most diesels today, specifically light-duty diesels, meaning in a pickup truck, you know, a Cummins in a Ram, a Duramax in a GM product, or a Power Stroke in a Ford product, have some sort of throttle plate. It's not really truly used to throttle the engine. It has to do with the EGR function. And I did a show a long time ago, probably in the past 6 months, about Tier 4 emissions, and I discussed it in length there. But those vehicles will also have a electronic throttle control, a drive-by-wire system. So this complexity, even though my focus of my talk is on gasoline engines, what's basically happening, this is migrating into the diesel side of it. And I would not be surprised if a lot of I should notice, right? But, you know, with in the farm equipment community, it's not as regular. It's in big equipment, farm equipment, construction equipment, it's not as regulated as far as the emissions are concerned. Their standards are not as stringent, and it's not as regulated as much as anything that's to go on the road. So cars and pickup trucks have to meet a lot more higher standards, and there has to be more commonality between them than there has to be with farm equipment or construction equipment, mining equipment. So the reason why I'm saying is that you may have, let's say, a versatile tractor with a Cummins engine and uses this particular system, or you may have a Case IH combine that uses a different system that they have, and you may have a John Deere that uses something else, or a Lexion combine that uses something else. So a lot of those systems are application specific to that brand, and that's an engineering way of saying, well, it's specific to that brand. You know, that's how they chose to do it. And the federal government doesn't mandate that there's a commonality between them to a certain extent. And the reason why the federal government mandates that, and I did a show on this also a while back, is about the right to repair. And the thing is that as far as the consumer is concerned, the federal government wants to protect them and have this commonality so that you don't have to go to the dealer to get your car fixed. They want to be able to give the consumer options. Once you get into something like farm equipment, mining equipment, or construction equipment, the federal government is only concerned about the emissions. They're not concerned with commonality because they look at that as a piece of business equipment, a la like a milling machine or a welder or a printing press. If you had to go back to Miller to get parts for your welder or get it fixed, the federal government doesn't care about that because there's no consumer boards protecting that. That's considered a piece of business equipment. So, you know, same thing if you have, you know, in an office building, if you have a Xerox copier, they don't care that you have to go to Xerox for that. The federal government's not going to say, well, you should be able to go someplace else and get parts for it. They're not going to say that, all right? They're not going to get involved in, or at least not yet, right, micromanage our lives. But in the consumer industry, in the car side of it, the pickup truck side, they felt that they don't want the manufacturer to have to force the consumer to come back there to get the car fixed or the pickup truck fixed or what have you. So the thing is that this system, electronic throttle control or drive-by-wire, may be on the combine that you're harvesting in right now as you're listening to the Idle Chatter podcast, or it may be on your sprayer, or it may not be. So, but the thing is that on your road vehicles, if they're in the last 10 or 11 years from that point on, if probably closer to 14 or 15 years, is that is going to be drive-by-wire, no throttle cable. So to recap here, why are they doing this? They're doing this to eliminate the larger hole through the firewall. They're doing this to eliminate mechanical complexity under the hood. It makes the vehicle easier to build. It makes the engine easier to build because you don't have all these solenoids and cables and connections going through. You just have a couple of wires, right? And what it also does is that it makes them, it takes away the, it eliminates the sub-circuits of the idle air control and cruise control. And another component of it, which I did not bring up yet, but this is just an FYI for you. It's not something that you're going to be able to take to the bank, is that by running the throttle electrically, electronic throttle control, is that they could get a better handle on emissions. Because the way that throttle closes, they could control the rate that that throttle closes. And if you notice with a lot of newer vehicles, when you lift the throttle on it, it doesn't seem to have the engine braking that the older vehicles did. And that's a combination of a number of things. It's that it's got many more speeds in a transmission. For like the new Ford pickup trucks have 10 speeds. It's a design of the torque converter. It's usually a lot less rolling resistance than we were used to having in a vehicle prior to it. But the other thing that comes up to play is that though you are releasing the throttle, that throttle may not be releasing as quickly as you release that accelerator pedal. And I am going to discuss that in a couple of more minutes as I get into the next part of the show. So in essence, these are all the things that they are doing. And because of, by letting that throttle close at a rate that the that they want, is going to minimize emissions. So it's a whole, you know, it's basically like farming today. It's not a singular approach. It's a whole systematic approach to what's going on here. But why you need to understand it is that this system has the potential to be problematic. And I want to give you a basic overview how it works. So now, when you get in your pickup truck that's drive-by-wire, and you step on the throttle, to accelerate out into the out onto the highway, what's going to happen is that you're pressing on this accelerator pedal, and a lot of work, a lot of engineering went into the fact that they felt that it was very important that they left that throttle pedal without a spring and without a cable felt very, very comfortable or natural, is probably the word I'm looking for, to the driver. So it felt as if, like the old days, that you were stepping and pulling a cable, that there was that certain amount of resistance, not over resistance, but just a certain amount of resistance so that you felt that you were actually moving the cable and opening the throttle body. So there was a ton of engineering work in that to get that feel of that pedal just right. Now the other thing that comes up is that, so when you step on that throttle pedal, and I'm going to give you a generic overview of this, and you may say one system is slightly different than the other. I'm going to fall back on application specific, but most road vehicles work this way. What's going to happen is there are two sensors on that pedal. And there are two sensors. If you look underneath the dashboard, look at the throttle pedal on a modern vehicle, there's going to be two sensors attached to it. And most computer sensors on engine management systems run between 0 and 5 volts. And so what's going to happen is you're going to have one sensor that reads from 0 to 5 volts. So it means 0 would be closed throttle, 5 volts would be full throttle. And the other sensor is going to read from 5 volts to 0. So it's a duplication of the signals, and they use that to compare, because one of the fears was that if one of these sensors goes bad or shorts out or what have you, that the engine doesn't run away on the person or the vehicle doesn't run away. So what they do is they use a comparator. So it's 0 to 5 volts and then 5 to 0 volts. And the computer, the microprocessor, knows that. So if you're at half throttle, let's use those numbers. If you're at half throttle, then both sensors should be at 2.5 volts, because it's 0 to 5 and 5 to 0. So what it does, it looks at that, and then it'll send that signal to the ECU, which is the electronic control unit, the engine management system. And then there's a table in the ECU. And let's use the 2.5 volts because it's a 50% throttle. And it's easy to understand when I'm doing a show like this and there's no visual attached to it, just audio. So if you now you're at 50% throttle, so the ECU sees that sensor, those two gas, some people call it the gas pedal sensors. It sees those two sensors, the values match, and then what it does, it sends a signal to the ECU, and the ECU says, we have to go to 50% throttle opening. This guy's trying to get this cattle trailer moving, right? It's loaded with purebred bulls in it. We got to get this cattle trailer moving, or you got totes of fertilizer in there, whatever. And what happens is that now the ECU sends a signal, and this is what I did not talk about before. There's actually an electric motor on the throttle body, and the electric motor is what it's going to do. It's a gear motor, and it's going to move the throttle plate as a cable would, but an electric motor is going to be moving it, so it'd be like an electric gate on a ranch or a farm. You have electric gate, you press the button, electric garage door, right? You press the button and the garage door opens, you press the button, the garage door closes. So the ECU sends a signal to this motor on the throttle body to open the throttle plate 50%, half open. Now, what will happen is that sort of the electric motor moves, and this responds very quickly, and that's why it's basically invisible to you as the driver. And the electric motor goes and opens the throttle plates to 50%. Now, on the throttle body is also a throttle position sensor. So this throttle position sensor now confirms to the ECU that the throttle is open the desired amount. In this particular instance that I'm talking about, it's 50%. So to recap, what happens is you're stepping on the gas pedal, the accelerator, you have two sensors there, it's reading it, and then what it's going to do, it's going to send a signal to the ECU, a voltage to the ECU interprets this voltage, sends a signal to the electric motor to open the throttle plate that much, and then also it sends, and then the throttle position sensor on the throttle body is the auditor, is the inspector, says, yes, you've opened at 50%. And then that is how that system works. Now, the pitfall of that system is that you need to have all three sensors agree, and you also need to have the electric motor respond the way it should. If one of those sensors does not agree with the other, what'll happen, and that's why I wanted to explain this to you, because as these vehicles get older, then what will happen is that you have run the possibility of one of those sensors skewing. And then when one of those sensors skew, the vehicle usually goes into what is called a limp home or a limp strategy, which is almost akin to a modern diesel running out of diesel exhaust fluid. So what's going to do is that the throttle pedal, the gas pedal is going to seem dead. The vehicle is going to have no power and would probably only achieve about 18 to 20 miles per hour, maybe 30 miles per hour with no load. So if you're going and you're pulling a load of hay with this pickup truck on a gooseneck trailer and you lose one of those sensor signals, it's going to put the check engine light on and this thing is going to come to a, I'm not going to say to a screeching halt, it's going to lose 99% of its power and at best chug along about 25 or 30 miles per hour. Now that could be very, very unnerving and that could also be problematic. So that's why I wanted to explain that to you, because if you're not familiar that the vehicle has drive-by-wire, you're out in the middle of the road someplace, 100 miles from the farm, and all of a sudden this truck or this car or your wife goes, the car won't go more than 10 miles an hour. What's going on here, right? And then you don't know what to do. At that particular point, it is usually because one of the sensors failed and or the motor that opens the throttle plates does not respond fast enough. And what it will do is that it is flagging that, and or the motor in the throttle plates, moving the throttle plates, got lazy and could not open the throttle. If it has to overcome a certain amount of resistance because of the throttle plates are dirty or gummed up, and or the proverbial little old lady from Pasadena car, right? Your mom and dad have a new pickup. They only take it to church. They never get on it. They never jump on it. They never open the throttle plates all the way because they're not going on the highway and whacking it to the floor. What happens is that throttle plate starts to stick. So I tell people that every once in a while, regardless of the use, you have to take, and the manufacturer won't tell you this, but the empirical, the real world of it is that you have to take those throttle plates every once in a while, and you have to take that car and get out on the highway and that truck and whack it a couple of times. You don't have to go 100 miles an hour and get a speeding ticket, but you want that throttle to go full throttle full deflection so that you exercise that motor and also that the throttle plate doesn't bind in its bushing in a certain area. And you also need maybe once a year to take that inlet duct off, and you need to take throttle body cleaner. You're not supposed to use carburetor cleaner because sometimes there's a coating on the throttle body that carburetor cleaner will impact. You're supposed to take throttle body cleaner and clean that throttle plate on both sides so it doesn't get dirty and have a binding, and also need to be opened more for the to get the proper idle speed. So that's the maintenance you need to do on it. And the other thing that you need to be concerned with specifically on the farm, and is that, you know, you're going in the mud, you're going out to check a center pivot, you're doing something, right? And the thing basically is that, you know, you come in there with muddy boots and what have you. You don't want to, those sensors are sealed, but you could still get stuff in there, right? And that probably would happen with a lot of flood vehicles. With the floods we had in the spring, is that they got just enough water in there to get the sensor wet and mess it all up. So if you have a problem like this, what you want to basically do is you need to check those gas pedal accelerator pump sensors, make sure that the wires are plugged in and there's not something going on there, or a wire chafed or a mouse ate it. And you need to look underneath the hood and go to the throttle body and see where those wires are and make sure the same thing happened. Not the same thing happened, that basically there's nothing going on there. And if that is the case where you can visually see something, then one of those sensors went bad, and or the motor on the throttle body went bad, or the throttle position sensor went bad. Sadly, lots of times you cannot buy this individually. They force you to buy a whole new throttle body, which is probably $1,000 to $1,500. So that's, you know, what we were able to do before with a cable. Now if it fails, is $1,000 to $1,500. And you're stuck on the side of the road with it, with a truck that's going 15 to 20 miles per hour. So, you know, I'm not going to pass judgment on it, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. I mean, I think that, you know, the old throttle cable was better. You never had any problems with it. I never put one in a car in my life. But it's important for you. And that's what the purpose of this show is. It's important for you to understand this technology, to understand what's going on with it, and what we need to do to work with it and hopefully maintain it. Because I don't want you to put $1,500 into a throttle body because you didn't keep it clean, or you didn't take it out on the road with mom and dad's car, and you didn't take it out on the road and just, like, you could go, you know, second gear, roll it out to second gear, whack it to the throttle, accelerate to 50, 60 miles per hour, get out, do it once or twice more. You don't have to go 100 miles an hour, but it's important for that. You know, think of any type of mechanical thing. If you have a gate and you only open it up 10 degrees, 10 degrees, 10 degrees, then what's going to happen is that it'll open up 10 degrees easy, but then it'll bind after that. The same thing happens with the drive-by-wire, with the electronic throttle control. The next thing is what they use that for. So if you have a newer vehicle and you have a mode, it says snow mode or ice mode or what have you, is they're able to dampen the throttle opening with that. So even though you're stepping on the throttle, instead of, we're in the normal mode, instead of the throttle opening 10% for that amount of gas pedal movement, it only opens 5% or 4%. And when you get into these vehicles, they say, you know, traction mode and traction control and snow mode, or you get like into a four-wheel drive, a rock climbing mode or what have you, what it does is it dampens the throttle opening. So it makes it slower. So you're stepping on the throttle and normally it would be open 10 degrees, but now it's only open 5 degrees, and that lets you, and then it opens up slower. So it lets the throttle be modulated for the slippery conditions. And you think that you're a great driver, but it's really assisting you. And then the other thing that they use it for is they go and they want to have the vehicle feel very peppy. So the drive away, as soon as you hit the throttle, so when you're going for the test drive, oh man, this thing jumps, look at this, son of a gun, well, look at that boy, I just stopped the gas, I'm going 40 miles an hour. Then what they basically do is they do the inverse of that. They have a rate of opening of the throttle, and in the beginning, as you first, it sees that accelerator pedal sensor change the delta value in it. So in other words, go from zero to one to half a volt very quickly. It opens up the throttle very quickly and then kind of brings it back. So it gives the consumer, to make him feel that the car is very peppy, the truck is very peppy right off the line. right from the start and then say, well, that's how peppy this thing is. And if you notice, if it seems peppier than if you whack it, it doesn't seem as strong as it did when you par throttle it. That's because it's opening up the throttle faster. But the thing is that that's all the games that are played, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with it. It gives you a nice driving vehicle. But to recap, what I want you to do is that if you have a drive-by-wire truck, which I'm sure most of you have at least one or two of those, or your wife's car, is that you need to every once in a while exercise that throttle plate. You need to be, you need to keep the throttle plate cleaned with spray throttle body cleaner. There's different brands. I use CRC brand, but there's different brands. You take the inlet duct off and you clean the throttle plates, and you take your finger and you open up the throttle plate against the electric motor. You won't hurt it with the key off, and you just open it up and you clean both sides. You want to exercise it, and if there ever is a problem, you want to check those connections, and you want to check those, visually check those sensors, and you want to try on the interior of like a pickup truck, you want to try not to get too much mud or anything behind it. So that is where we are at with that. Any questions on that, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. Okay, so now what we're going to do is we're going to start our first toolbox test. Then what I was looking for is I didn't want to just go into this. I wanted to make this, this show is so educational. I try to make it fun. I try to make it entertaining to learn with entertainment and education, and entertaining education. So I was looking for a song to have a few seconds of a song that would bring us into the toolbox test. And I found this wonderful, well, I thought it was wonderful, rockabilly song. I love it. And I am the Hot Rod Farmer. And this song says that he is the Hot Rod Man. So I was really excited about that. And this, it, this song is called Hot Rod Man, and it's by Tex Rubinowitz, and it is only on Ripsaw Records. And Ripsaw Records, if you go to their website, you know, ripsawrecords.com, that it is the cutting edge of rock and roll. So it, this is a rockabilly song. I love it. Hopefully you like it. And whenever you hear, from now on in, whenever you hear Tex singing the Hot Rod Man, then you know that the toolbox test is coming up now.
Well, I'm a rolling daddy with a mean machine. It's got a V8 motor and it sure is clean. I'm a hot rod man. Yeah, I'm a hot rod man. Well, look out, little mama, gonna get you if I can.
All righty, thank you so much, Tex. Hopefully you guys enjoyed that. And as I said, that's Tex Rubinowitz, the Hot Rod Man. And it's for all us hot rod farmer guys and gals out there, or hot rod guys and gals, right? So, all righty. So what I'm going to do, this toolbox test question is from test number one. And it is, I'm going to read it to you. Your liquid cooled UTV started to run hot according to the gauge. You checked the water pump drive belt, radiator, and coolant level, and all seemed fine. You decided to change the thermostat in the hope that it is the problem. The parts man at the dealership hands you the proper thermostat, and you notice it is stamped on it 180. You ask the counterman what that means, and he tells you it is the temperature rating. You install the new thermostat, and all is now fine. The next day at the coffee shop, you ask your farmer friends what the 180 stamped on the thermostat means. Which farmer is correct? Farmer A says it is the manufacturing code or part number, and it means nothing to the end user. Farmer B claims it is the liquid temperature in Fahrenheit degrees that the thermostat is fully open. Farmer C tells you it is the crack open temperature in Fahrenheit degrees when the thermostat begins to open. Farmer D says that it is the size of the thermostat in millimeters. So in essence, that's what you have to decide. What does the number on the thermostat mean? And after we answer, or I answer the special delivery letter, and before the end of the show, I will give you the proper answer to that. And if you want to get more toolbox tests, please go to my website and for the next 5 weeks, I'm going to be going off the test number one. So if you want to cheat, you could cheat an open book test, and you could go there and take that. You could take the test on the website before next week's show, because next week's show I'll have question number two. So hopefully you enjoy that. And it's all about learning, because the educated farmer is the most profitable one. And I always want you guys to be educated, and I want you to be profitable. So now we're going to go into our special delivery section. And as you know, special delivery is brought to us by Firestone Ag, a company founded by Harvey Firestone, a fourth generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today and lives on with their 23 degree tread bar design, AD2 technology, which is the IF and VF tires that we discussed last week in last week's show, and now the Firestone of replacement tracks. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. So now we have a question, and I will read it to you. If you hear some papers moving around, that's because I had to print this all off, and this microphone is much better than what I'm used to having, so it picks up everything. So just forgive me for that. So it says, hi, my name is Tom, and I live in Montana. Where they're getting some, he's not saying this, but they're getting hit with some bad snows this week out there. I really feel for those people out west with those snows in the Dakotas, Montana, especially the cattlemen, because those, I remember a number of years ago, all those poor cows just froze to death. It was terrible. I mean, I still want to cry when I think about it. What a terrible, terrible way to go. Those poor animals didn't deserve that. But anyway, I'll get back to his question. Hi, my name is Tom, and I live in Montana. I recently found your website and podcast. Great information. Well, thank you, Tom. I have a simple question that you may have already answered. Is synthetic oil worth the extra money? Thanks so much. Alrighty. Well, first of all, to answer your question up front and very, very bluntly, in my estimation, yes, it is, depending upon the use that it's going to go into. That's, you know, that's the engineer thing, application specific, right? There's always a caveat attached to it. And the thing is that synthetic oils, the benefit of a synthetic oil is that its viscosity is more constant, and also it flows much better in cold and has more protection when hot. So if you take a mineral oil is not going to have the same what they call with oil pumpability when it is cold, and it's not going to be able to offer as much oil wedge protection. The oil wedge is what separates the main bearings and the crank bearings from rubbing, and it's a thin layer of oil. It's not the clearance of the bearing, it's called the oil wedge. But a synthetic oil, because it is synthesized, it is made from a different base stock, and it is so manipulated that through a synthesization process that its molecular structure changes so much that it's called a synthetic oil. And that's a simplistic overview of it. And then what happens, because of it's a synthetic and because it goes through this, let's call it a very, very, very highly refined process, is that it's purer in sense and is able to pump quicker. So it's able to get all of the parts oiled quicker. It's also able to withstand heat better than a mineral-based oil. But now, as an aside to that, the mineral-based oils are much, 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 much better than they were years ago. We've learned how to make oil better. And the thing is that the mineral-based oils today are probably akin to what a synthetic oil was 25 or 30 years ago. So the mineral oils got better, but also at the same time, the synthetic oils got better. So everything, so if you look at it, it's almost like crop yield, right? Whereas before we had 100 bushels per acre national average and 120, 130. Now we have probably around 170 bushels per acre of corn national average, give or take. I don't know what we'll have this year. But in other words, just like the yields went up, it was, they learned how to make mineral oil better, and they learned how to make synthetic oil better. So the bars on both of them were being raised. And the fact that I like to use a synthetic oil, and I use synthetic oil in everything, even in my pressure washer, my lawn mower, my DR brush mower, my lawn tractor. I use it in my farm tractors. I use it in my cars, my pickup trucks. I use synthetic oil because I feel that the couple of dollars extra that you pay for that is giving you more pumpability when it's cold. So you're getting all those parts oiled quicker. And that's specifically important in a late model engine that's overhead cam, because the majority of the components are up in the cylinder head. And that's as far from the oil pan as you could get. So you want to get that oil up there very, very quickly. And then you also want to be able to have that oil withstand high temperatures. My oil and all of my applications don't get that hot, probably gets the hottest in the farm tractor because it's working the hardest. But still, you want that level of protection, and you want that there's something in oil. And I did a show a while back on it. So Tom, if you want to go to my archives, I think I called that show Slippery Subject, and it really goes into oil, and you may want to listen to that because it's a full podcast on oils and understanding them. And you know what you really need to understand about oil, not to become a chemist. And what's going to happen is that it's a very, very cheap insurance policy for keeping an engine and protecting it, and whether regardless of what the engine is. So if it costs you a couple of dollars more a year to run a synthetic oil versus a mineral oil, then I would say do it. But keep in mind, I am not against mineral oil. The mineral oil today is excellent, 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 excellent. So the that is really, you know, where we're at with that. Now, to add to this, there is also what's called a synthetic blend oil. And a synthetic blend oil is a semi-synthetic, some people call it. It's a combination of a synthetic, a full synthetic, and a mineral oil. And those are excellent oils, and they're middle of the road oils, because some synthetic oils, like everything in life, it's a double-sided sword. There's something that's called wettability with oil. And wettability is it's able to, how long it could stand apart after the oil stops flowing through the pressurized system. And synthetic oil has a very poor rate of wettability. So it's almost like silver paint. It runs off of everything very quickly. Whereas if you have a semi-synthetic or a synthetic blend, has a higher degree of wettability. So if you have an engine that you don't run that often, and it's sitting in the shed or what have you, you may actually want to trade some of the cold pumpability and the high temperature, because you may never get the 350 degree oil temperature, which I doubt if you would, or even 300 degrees. You may want to trade some of that to have the greater degree of wettability, meaning that the oil stays on those parts longer when you shut that engine off. So it's giving it corrosion protection because it's staying on there longer. So if you have an engine that, say, that's like with a hay bind or something, and you're only going to use it a certain time of year, and then the rest of the year it's sitting, eventually that oil is going to run off the parts also. If it stays there for 6 months, it's going to run off the parts, or 2 months. But if you had something that's sitting more than it's being used, you may want to trade some of that and use a semi-synthetic, a synthetic blend for the wettability. But you don't be afraid to use a synthetic also. So now the thing is that if you have an older engine that has a lot of hours and a lot of use on it, you would probably want to stick with a mineral-based oil, simply because if it's not used much and it's very old and it had mineral oil in its whole life, and all of its oil is what's considered fungible, meaning it's so alike in chemical composition that you could mix brands and types and not have any adverse effect. But every engine oil does have a certain swelling agent in it, a swell factor. And the thing is that even though they claim that the synthetic oils today have the same swell factor for the seals that the mineral oils have, you may have, due to the chemical composition in that oil, you may have a slightly different swell rate. And plus the reduced molecular size, the molecule size of the synthetic oil from the process to synthesize it. Hey, I said the word right, synthesize it. Is that it makes the engine prone to leak. A lot of people would say, well, I put synthetic oil in, the rear main started to leak. I took it back out and I put mineral oil in, and it stopped leaking. And the thing basically is that's usually due to two things. Number one, the conditioning of the seal and the swelling agent that's used in it may have actually shrunk the seal, but probably more importantly and more common is that the molecular structure on synthetic oil is smaller. so it's more prone to leak past the seal, for instance, like a lip seal that'll ride on the crankshaft. So it is more prone to leak past there because of that. So to answer your question, before we get into the answer on our toolbox test, is that yes, I do think synthetic oils are worth the money. There are times where I would probably use a mineral oil, as I said. And if you have the opportunity, Tom, please go to my website or any one of my podcasting hosting sites and look up, I think it was called Slippery Subject. It was probably about 2 or 3 months ago. And it was a show dedicated to oils and what the farmer needs to know about it. So, all righty. So we're going to end with our first toolbox test question answer here. And if you hear the pages slipping, like I said, I'm going to read this so I don't go off on a tangent and go on for 2 hours like I like to do. So bear with me and let me find this here. Alrighty. So in essence, to recap what the question is, the number, the temperature rating stamped on a thermostat, what does that mean? And the farmer C is correct, or was correct. The rating on the thermostat is the crack open temperature. That is when the liquid flow to the radiator begins. Most thermostats take an additional rise in liquid temperature of between 10 and 20 degrees Fahrenheit to become fully open. So the rating on the thermostat, 180, means it's going to crack open at 180. It's going to start to flow coolant to the radiator, and it is going to then take another 10 to 20 degrees for that thermostat to fully open. Alrighty, so that is your answer. And hopefully you enjoyed that music, compliments of Tex Rubinowitz and Ripsaw Records. And then when you hear that from now on in, when I hit that button and that music starts to play, that hot rod man with the V8 engine, he's got a clean V8, he says in those texts. And if you want to hear that song more, just go to do a search for Tex Rubinowitz and you could get the whole album on YouTube, or go to Ripsaw Records and you will be able to hear it. So listen, I don't know how the audio came out in this. Hopefully it came out great and you enjoyed it. I want to thank you so much for listening. I want to thank you so much for putting up with me for this dry land farmer who's struggling through this technology and trying to get the word out to you. And know that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved, beloved America. If you're in harvest and you listen to this now, have a safe and blessed harvest. And we'll catch you next week. Thanks so much.